What's the rest, then?
Her voice was calm, blue eyes straight and level.
Well, what if he had told her? There she was, with you, a young child. And remember, neither of them would have thought that you might cross through the stones as well.
The eyes were still straight, but clouded once more with trouble.
She would have had to choose, she said softly, her gaze fixed on him. To stay with us, or go to him, to Jamie. To leave you behind, Roger said, nodding. Or to stay and live her life, knowing her Jamie was alive. Maybe reachable, but out of reach. Break her vows, on purpose this time, and abandon her child. Or live with yearning.
I can't see that would have done your family life much good.
I see.
She sighed, the steam of her exhaled breath disappearing like a ghost in cold air.
Perhaps Frank was afraid to give her the choice, Roger said. But he did save her, and you, from the pain of having to make it. At least then.
Her lips drew in, pushed out, relaxed.
I wonder what her choice would have been if he had told her, she said, a little bleakly.
He laid his hand on hers, squeezed lightly.
She would have stayed, he said with certainty. She made the choice once, did she not? Jamie sent her back to keep you safe, and she went. She would have known he wanted that, and she would have stayed, so long as you needed her. She wouldn't have gone back, even when she did, save that you'd insisted. You ken that well enough, surely.
Her face eased a bit, accepting this.
I guess you're right, but still. To know he was alive and not try to reach him.
He bit the inside of his cheek to keep from asking.
If it were your choice, Brianna, if it was the bairn or me...
For how could any man force a choice like that on a woman whom he loved, even hypothetically? Whether for her sake or his own, he wouldn't ask.
But he did put that gravestone there. Why did he do that?
The line between her brows was still deep, but no longer straight. It twisted with a growing perturbation. He hadn't known Frank Randall, but he felt a certain empathy for the man, and not only a disinterested sympathy either. He hadn't fully realised why he'd felt he must tell her about the letter now, before the wedding, but his own motives were becoming clearer and more disturbing to him by the moment.
I think it was obligation, as I said, not just to Jamie or your mother, to you. If it...
He started, then stopped and squeezed her hand hard.
Look, take wee Jamie. He's mine as much as you are. He always will be.
He took a deep breath.
But if I were the other man...
If you were Stephen Bonnet, she said,
and her lips were tight, gone white with chill.
If I were Bonnet, he agreed, with a qualm of distaste at the notion. If I knew the child was mine, and yet he was being raised by a stranger, would I not want the child to know the truth? Sometime.
Her fingers convulsed in his, and her eyes went dark.
You mustn't tell him.
Roger, for God's sake, promise me you won't tell him, ever. He stared at her in astonishment. Her nails were digging painfully into his hand, but he made no move to free himself.
Bonnet? Christ, no. If I ever see the man again, I'll not waste time talking.
Not Bonnet? She shuddered, whether from cold or emotion he couldn't tell.
God, keep away from that man. No, it's Jemmy I mean.
She swallowed hard and gripped both his hands.
Promise me, Roger, if you love me, promise that you'll never tell Jemmy about Bonnet. Never. Even if something happens to me.
Nothing will happen to you.
She looked at him, and a small, wry smile formed on her lips.
Celibacy's not my thing either.
It might...
She swallowed. And if it does,
promise me, Roger.
Aye, I promise, he said reluctantly. If you're sure.
I'm sure.
Would you not have wanted ever to know, then? About Jamie?
She bit her lip at that, her teeth sinking deep enough to leave a purple mark in the soft pink flesh.
Jamie Fraser is not Stephen Bonnet.
Agreed,
he said dryly. But I wasn't speaking of Jemmy to start with. All I meant was that if I were Bonnet, I should want to know, and...
He does know. She pulled her hand from his abruptly and stood up, turning away.
He what?
He caught up with her in two strides and grabbed her by the shoulder, turning her back to face him. She flinched slightly and he loosened his grip. He took a deep breath, fighting to keep his voice calm.
Bonnet knows about Jemmy?
Worse than that. Her lips were trembling. She pressed them tightly together to stop it, then opened them just enough to let the truth escape. He thinks Jemmy is his. She wouldn't sit down with him again, but he drew her arm tightly through his and made her walk with him, walk through the falling rain and tumbled stones, past the rush of the creek and the swaying trees, until the movement calmed her enough to talk, to tell him about her days left alone at River Run, a prisoner of her pregnancy, about Lord John Grey, her father's friend, and hers, how she had confided to Lord John her fears and struggles.
I was afraid you were dead. All of you. Mama, Da, you.
Her hood had fallen back, and she made no effort to reclaim it. Her red hair hung in dripping rat tails on her shoulders, and droplets clung to her thick red brows.
The last thing Da said to me. He didn't say it, even. He wrote it. He had to write it. I wouldn't talk to him.
She swallowed and ran a hand beneath her nose, wiping away a pendant drop.
He said I had to find a way to forgive him. Bonnet.
To do what?
She pulled her arm away slightly, and he realized how hard his fingers were digging into her flesh. He loosened his grip with a small grunt of apology, and she tilted her head briefly toward him in acknowledgement.
He knew, she said, and stopped.
She turned to face him, her feelings now in hand.
You know what happened to him at Wentworth?
Roger gave a short, awkward nod.
In actuality, he had no clear notion what had been done to Jamie Fraser, and had no wish to know more than he did.
He had seen the scars on Fraser's back, though, and knew from the few things Claire had said that these were but a faint reminder.
He knew, she said steadily, and he knew what had to be done. He told me if I wanted to be whole again, I had to find a way to forgive Stephen Bonnet.
So I did. He had Brianna's hand in his, held so tight that he felt the small shift of her bones. She hadn't told him. He hadn't asked. The name of Stephen Bonnet had never been mentioned between them. Not until now.
You did.
He spoke gruffly and had to stop to clear his throat.
You found him, then? You spoke to him?
She brushed wet hair back from her face, nodding. Grey had come to her, told her that Bonnet had been taken, condemned. Awaiting transport to Wilmington and execution, he was being held in the cellar beneath the Crown Warehouse in Cross Creek. It was there she had gone to him, bearing what she hoped was absolution, for Bonnet, for herself.
I was huge.
Her hand sketched the bulge of advanced pregnancy before her.
I told him the baby was his. He was going to die, and maybe it would be some comfort to him to think that there'd be something left.
Roger felt jealousy grip his heart, so abrupt in its attack that for a moment he thought the pain was physical.
Something left, he thought. Something of him. And what of me? If I die tomorrow, and I might, girl, life's chancy here for me as well as you. What will be left of me? Tell me that.
He oughtn't ask. He knew that. He'd vowed never to voice the thought that Jemmy wasn't his, ever.
If there was a true marriage between them, then Jem was the child of it, no matter the circumstances of his birth. And yet he felt the words spill out, burning like acid.
So you were sure the child was his?
She stopped dead and turned to look at him, eyes wide with shock.
No! No, of course not! If I knew that, I would have told you.
The burning in his chest eased just a little.
Oh. But you told him it was. You didn't say to him that there was doubt about it.
He was going to die. I wanted to give him some comfort, not to tell him my life story. It wasn't any of his goddamn business to hear about you or our wedding night, or damn you, Roger!
She kicked him in the shin. He staggered with the force of it, but grabbed her arm, preventing her from running off.
"I'm sorry," he said, before she could kick him again, or bite him, which she looked prepared to do. "I'm sorry." "You're right, it wasn't his business. And it's not my business either, to be making you think of it all again."
She drew in a deep breath through her nose, like a dragon preparing to sear him into ash. The spark of fury in her eyes lessened slightly, though her cheeks still blazed with it. She shook off his hand, but didn't run away.
"Yes, it is," she said.
She gave him a dark, flat look.
"You said there shouldn't be secrets between us, and you were right.
But when you tell a secret, sometimes there's another one behind it, isn't there?"
"Yeah, but it's not... I don't mean..."
Before he could say any more, the sound of feet and conversation interrupted him. Four men came out of the mist, speaking casually in Gaelic. They carried sharpened sticks and nets, and all were barefoot, wet to the knees. Strings of fresh caught fish gleamed dully in the rain light. "Asmerach?" One man, peering out from under the sodden brim of his slouch hat, caught sight of them and broke into a broad grin as shrewd eyes passed over their dishevelment.
"It is yourself, Thrush, and the daughter of the Red One, too. What, can you not restrain yourself until the darkness?"
"No doubt it is sweeter to taste stolen fruit than to wait on a blessing from a shrivelled priest."
Another man thrust back his bonnet on his head and clasped himself briefly, making clear just what he meant by shrivelled.
"Oh, no,"
said the third, wiping drops from the end of his nose as he eyed Brianna, her cloak pulled tight round her.
"He's no but after singing her a wee wedding song, is he not?"
"I know the words to that song, too,"
said his companion, his grin broadening enough to show a missing molar.
"But I sing it still more sweetly."
Brianna's cheeks had begun to blaze again. Her Gaelic was less fluent than Roger's, but she was certainly able to gather the sense of crude teasing. Roger stepped in front of her, shielding her with his body. The men meant no harm, though. They winked and grinned appreciatively, but made no further comment. The first man pulled off his hat and beat it against his thigh, shedding water, then set to business.
"It is glad I am to be meeting you thus. My mother did hear your music at the fire last night, and told it to my aunts and my cousins, how your music was making the blood dance in her feet. So now they will hear nothing but that you must come and sing for the Cayley at Spring Creek. It is my youngest cousin will be wed, and her the only child of my uncle who owns the flour mill."
"It will be a great affair, surely,"
put in one of the younger men, the son of the first speaker by his resemblance to the former.
"Oh, it's a wedding," said Roger, in slow, formal Gaelic. "We'll have an extra herring, then."
The two older men burst into laughter at the joke, but their sons merely looked bewildered.
"Ah, the lads would not be knowing a herring, 'twas it slapped wet against their cheeks," said the bonneted man, shaking his head. "Born here, the two of them."
"And where was your home in Scotland, sir?"
The man jerked, surprised at the question, put in clear-voiced Gaelic. He stared at Brianna for a moment, then his face changed as he answered her.
"Skye," he said softly. "Skibost, near the foot of the Coolins.
I am Angus MacLeod, and Skye is the land of my sires and my grandsires. But my sons were born here."
He spoke quietly, but there was a tone in his voice that quelled the hilarity in the younger men as though a damp blanket had been thrown over them. The man in the slouch hat looked at Brianna with interest.
"And were you born in Scotland, Ian?"
She shook her head mutely, drawing the cloak higher on her shoulders.
"I was," said Roger, answering a look of inquiry. "In Kyle of Lochalsh."
"Ah," said MacLeod, satisfaction spreading itself across his weathered features.
"It is so, then, that you know all the songs of the Highlands and the Isles?"
"Not all," said Roger, smiling, "but many, and I will learn more."
"Do that," said MacLeod, nodding slowly. "Do that, singer, and teach them to your sons."
His eye lighted on Brianna, and a faint smile curled on his lips.
"Let them sing to my sons that they will know the place they came from, though they will never see it."
One of the younger men stepped forward, bashfully holding out a string of fish, which he presented to Brianna.
"For you," he said, "a gift for your wedding."
Roger could see one corner of her mouth twitch slightly. With humour or incipient hysteria, he wondered. But she stretched out a hand and took the dripping string with grave dignity. She picked up the edge of her cloak with one hand and swept them all a deep curtsy.
"I have no words to say to you, but thanks," she said, in her slow, strangely accented Gaelic.
The young men went pink, and the older men looked deeply pleased.
"It is good, Ian," said MacLeod. "Let your husband teach you, then, and teach the Gaelic to your sons. May you have many."
He swept off his bonnet and bowed extravagantly to her, bare toes squelching in the mud to keep his balance.
"Many sons, strong and healthy," chimed in his companions, and the two lads smiled and nodded, murmuring shyly, "Many sons to you, mistress."
Roger made the arrangements for the Cayley automatically, not daring to look at Brianna. They stood in silence, a foot or two apart, as the men left, casting curious looks behind them. Brianna stared down into the mud and grass where they stood, arms crossed in front of her. The burning feeling was still in Roger's chest, but now it was different. He wanted to touch her, to apologize again, but he thought that would only make things worse. In the end, she moved first. She came to him and laid her head on his chest, the coolness of her wet hair brushing the wound in his throat. Her breasts were huge, hard as rocks against his chest, pushing against him, pushing him away.
"I need Jemmy," she said softly. "I need my baby."
The words jammed in his throat, caught between apology and anger. He hadn't realized how much it would hurt to think of Jemmy as belonging to someone else. Not his, but Bonnet's.
"I need him too,"
he whispered at last, and kissed her briefly on the forehead before taking her hand across the meadow once again. The mountain above lay shrouded in mist, invisible, though shouts and murmurs, scraps of speech and music drifted down like echoes from Olympus. Chapter 7. Shrapnel. The drizzle had stopped by mid-morning, and brief glimpses of pale blue sky showed through the clouds, giving me some hope that it might clear by evening. Proverbs and omens quite aside, I didn't want the wedding ceremonies dampened for Brianna's sake. It wouldn't be St. James's with rice and white satin, but it could at least be dry. I rubbed my right hand, working out the cramp from the tooth-pulling pliers. Mr. Goodwin's broken tooth had been more troublesome to extract than I expected, but I'd managed to get it out, roots and all, sending him away with a small bottle of raw whiskey and instructions to swish it round his mouth once an hour to prevent infection. Swallowing was optional. I stretched, feeling the pocket under my skirt swing against my leg with a small but gratifying chink. Mr. Goodwin had indeed paid cash. I wondered whether it was enough for an astrolabe, and what on earth Jamie wanted with one. My speculations were disturbed, though, by a small but official-sounding cough behind me. I turned around to find Archie Hayes looking mildly quizzical.
"Oh," I said.
"Ah, can I help you, Lieutenant?"
"Well, that says me be Mistress Fraser," he said, looking me over with a slight smile. "Farquhar Campbell said his slaves are convinced that you can raise the dead, so it might be as a bit of stray metal would pose no great trial to your skills as a surgeon."
Murray MacLeod, overhearing, uttered a loud snort at this and turned away to his own waiting patients.
"Oh," I said again, and rubbed a finger under my nose, embarrassed.
One of Campbell's slaves had suffered an epileptic seizure 4 days before, happening to recover abruptly from it just as I laid an exploratory hand on his chest. In vain had I tried to explain what had happened. My fame had spread like wildfire over the mountain. Even now, a small group of slaves squatted near the edge of the clearing, playing at knucklebones, and waiting till the other patients should be attended to. I gave them a narrow eye, just in case. If one of them were dying, or dangerously ill, I knew they would make no effort to tell me, both from deference to my white patients, and from their confident conviction that if anything drastic should happen while they were waiting, I would simply resurrect the corpse at my own convenience and deal with the problem then. All of them seemed safely vertical at the moment, though, and likely to remain so for the immediate future. I turned back to Hayes, wiping muddy hands on my apron. "Well, let me see the bit of metal, why don't you, and I'll see what can be done." Nothing loath, Hayes stripped off bonnet, coat, waistcoat, stock, and shirt, together with the silver gorget of his office. He handed his garments to the aide who accompanied him and sat down on my stool, his placid dignity quite unimpaired by partial nakedness, by the goose flesh that stippled his back and shoulders, or by the murmur of awed surprise that went up from the waiting slaves at sight of him. His torso was nearly hairless, with the pale, suety colour of skin that had gone years with no exposure to sunlight, in sharp contrast to the weathered brown of his hands, face, and knees. The contrasts went further than that, though. Over the milky skin of his left breast was a huge patch of bluish-black that covered him from ribs to clavicle. And while the nipple on the right was a normal brownish-pink, the one on the left was a startling white. I blinked at the sight and heard a soft, "Oh dear," behind me.
"By God, he is turning black," said another voice, somewhat louder.
Hayes appeared not to hear any of this, but sat back to let me make my examination. Close inspection revealed that the dark coloration was not natural pigmentation, but a mottling caused by the presence of innumerable small dark granules embedded in the skin. The nipple was gone altogether, replaced by a patch of shiny white scar tissue the size of a sixpence. "Gunpowder," I said, running my fingertips lightly over the darkened area. I'd seen such things before, caused by a misfire or shot at close range, which drove particles of powder, and often bits of wadding and cloth, into the deeper layers of the skin. Sure enough, there were small bumps beneath the skin, evident to my fingertips, dark fragments of whatever garment he'd been wearing when shot.
"Is the ball still in you?"
I could see where it had entered. I touched the white patch, trying to envision the path the bullet might have taken thereafter.
"Half of it is," he replied tranquilly. "It shattered. When the surgeon went to dig it out, he gave me the bits of it. When I fitted them together after, I couldn't make but half a ball, so the rest of it must have stayed."
"Shattered?
I wonder the pieces didn't go through your heart or your lung," I said, squatting down in order to squint more closely at the injury. "Oh, it did," he informed me. "At least I suppose that it must, for it came in at my breast, as you see, but it's kicking out from my back just now."
To the astonishment of the multitudes, as well as my own, he was right. I could not only feel a small lump just under the outer border of his left scapula, I could actually see it, a darkish swelling pressing against the soft white skin. "I'll be damned," I said, and he gave a small grunt of amusement, whether at my surprise or my language, I couldn't tell. Odd as it was, the bit of shrapnel presented no surgical difficulty. I dipped a cloth into my bowl of distilled alcohol, wiped the area carefully, sterilized a scalpel, and cut quickly into the skin. Hayes sat quite still as I did it. He was a soldier and a Scot, and, as the markings on his breast bore witness, he had endured much worse than this. I spread two fingers and pressed them on either side of the incision. The lips of the small slit pouted, then a dark, jagged bit of metal suddenly protruded like a stuck-out tongue, far enough for me to grasp it with forceps and pull it free. I dropped the discoloured lump into Hayes's hand with a small exclamation of triumph, then clapped a pad soaked with alcohol against his back. He expelled a long breath between pursed lips and smiled over his shoulder at me.
"I thank you, Mrs. Fraser. This wee fellow has been wee me for some time now, but I canna say as I'm grieved to part company with him."
He cupped his blood-smeared palm, peering at the bit of fractured metal in it with great interest.
"How long ago did it happen?" I asked curiously.
I didn't think the bit of shrapnel had actually passed completely through his body, though it certainly gave the illusion of having done so. More likely, I thought, it had remained near the surface of the original wound and travelled slowly round the torso, propelled between skin and muscle by Hayes's movements until reaching its present location.
"Oh, 20 years and more, mistress," he said.
He touched the patch of tough, numbed white that had once been one of the most sensitive spots on his body.
"That happened at Culloden."
He spoke casually, but I felt goose flesh ripple over my arms at the name.
20 years and more.
25 more like.
At which point...
"You can't have been more than 12, I said.
"No," he replied, one eyebrow lifted. 11. My birthday was the next day, though."
I choked back whatever I might have said in reply. I had thought I had lost my capacity to be shocked by the realities of the past, but evidently not. Someone had shot him. An 11-year-old boy at point-blank range. No chance of mistake. No shot gone awry in the heat of battle. The man who had shot him had known it was a child he meant to kill, and had fired anyway. My lips pressed tight as I examined my incision. No more than an inch long, and not deep, the fractured ball had lain just below the surface. Good. It wouldn't need stitching. I pressed a clean pad to the wound and moved in front of him to fasten the linen strip that bound it in place.
"A miracle you survived," I said.
"It was that," he agreed. "I was lying on the ground and Murchison's face over me, and I..."
"Murchison!"
The exclamation popped out of me, and I saw a flicker of satisfaction cross Hayes's face. I had a brief premonitory qualm, remembering what Jamie had said about Hayes the night before.
"He thinks more than he says, does wee Archie. And he talks quite a lot. Be careful of him, Sassenach."
Well, a little late for caution, but I doubted it could matter, even if it had been the same Murchison.
"You'll ken the name, I see,"
Hayes observed pleasantly.
"I had heard in England that a Sergeant Murchison of the 26th was sent to North Carolina, but the garrison at Cross Creek was gone when we reached the town. A fire, was it?"
Yes, I said,
rather edgy at this reference. I was glad that Bree had left. Only two people knew the whole truth of what had happened when the Crown's warehouse on Cross Creek burned, and she was one of them. As for the other, well, Stephen Bonnet wasn't likely to cross paths with the lieutenant any time soon, if Bonnet himself was still alive.
"And the men of the garrison," Hayes pursued, "Murchison and the rest, where have they gone, do you know?"
"Sergeant Murchison is dead,"
said a deep, soft voice behind me. Alas.
Hayes looked beyond me and smiled.
Ashe, Masrur, he said. I did think you might come to your wife sooner or later. I've been seeking you the morn.
I was startled at the name, and so was Jamie. A look of surprise flashed across his features, then disappeared, replaced by wariness. No one had called him Red Jamie since the days of the Rising.
I heard, he said dryly.
He sat down on my extra stool, facing Hayes.
Let's have it, then. What is it?
Hayes pulled up the sporran that dangled between his knees, rummaged for a moment, and pulled out a square of folded paper, secured with a red wax seal, marked with a crest I recognised. My heart skipped a beat at the sight. I somehow doubted that Governor Tryon was sending me a belated birthday wish. Hayes turned it over, checked carefully to see that the name inscribed on the front was Jamie's, and handed it across. To my surprise, Jamie didn't open it at once, but sat holding it, eyes fixed on Hayes's face.
"What brought you here?" he asked abruptly.
"Ah, duty, to be sure," Hayes answered, thin brows arched in innocent astonishment. "Does a soldier do aught for any other reason?"
"Duty?"
Jamie repeated. He tapped the missive idly against his leg.
"Aye, well,
duty might take you from Charleston to Virginia, but there are quicker ways to get there."
Hayes started to shrug, but desisted at once as the movement jarred the shoulder I was bandaging.
"I had the proclamation to bring from Governor Tryon. The governor's no authority over you or your men."
"True," Hayes agreed. "But why should I not do the man a service, and I could?"
"Aye. And did he ask you to do him the service, or was it your own notion?"
Jamie said, a distinct tone of cynicism in his voice.
"You've grown a bit suspicious in your old age, Seamus Ruhr,"
Hayes said, shaking his head reprovingly.
"That's how I've lived to grow as old as I have,"
Jamie replied, smiling slightly. He paused, eyeing Hayes.
"You say it was a man named Murchison who shot you on the field at Dromorsey?"
I had finished the bandaging. Hayes moved his shoulder experimentally, testing for pain.
"Why, you ken that, surely, Ashimus Ruhr. Do you not recall the day, man?"
Jamie's face changed subtly, and I felt a small tremor of unease. The fact was that Jamie had almost no memory of the last days of the clans, of the slaughter that had left so many bleeding in the rain, him among them. I knew that small scenes from that day came back to him now and again in his sleep, fragments of nightmare. But whether it was from trauma, injury, or simple force of will, the Battle of Culloden was lost to him, or had been until now. I didn't think he wanted it back.
"A great deal happened then," he said. "I dinna remember everything, no."
He bent his head abruptly and thrust a thumb beneath the fold of the letter, opening so roughly that the wax seal shattered into fragments.
"Your husband's a modest man, Mistress Freezer."
Hayes nodded to me as he summoned his aide with a flip of the hand.
"Has he never told you what he did that day?"
"There was a good bit of gallantry on that field,"
Jamie muttered, head bent over the letter.
"And quite a bit of the reverse."
I didn't think he was reading. His eyes were fixed, as though he was seeing something else, beyond the paper that he held.
"Aye. There was," Hayes agreed. "But it does seem worth remark when a man saved your life, no?"
Jamie's head jerked up at that, startled. I moved across to stand behind him, a hand laid lightly on his shoulder. Hayes took the shirt from his aide and put it slowly on, smiling in an odd, half-watchful way.
"You dinna recall how you struck Murchison across the head just as he was set to bayonet me on the ground? And then you picked me up and carried me from the field awa' to a bitty well nearby. One of the chiefs lay on the grass there, and his men were bathing his heed in the water, but I could see he was dead.
He lay so still. There was someone there to tend me. They wished ye to stay too, for ye were wounded and bleeding, but you would not. You wished me well in the name of St. Michael, and went back then, to the field. Hayes settled the chain of his gorget, adjusting the small silver crescent beneath his chin. Without his stock, his throat looked bare, defenceless.
You looked fair wild, man, for there was blood running down your face and your hair was loose on the wind.
You'd sheathed your sword to carry me, but you pulled it again as you turned away.
I didn't think I should see you again, for if ever I saw a man set to meet his death.
He shook his head, his eyes half closed, as though he saw not the sober, stalwart man before him, not the Fraser of Fraser's Ridge, but Red Jamie, the young warrior who had not gone back from gallantry, but because he sought to throw his life away, feeling it a burden, because he had lost me.
"Did I?"
Jamie muttered.
"I had forgotten."
I could feel the tension in him singing like a stretched wire under my hand. A pulse beat quick in the artery beneath his ear.
There were things he had forgotten, but not that.
Neither had I. Hayes bent his head as his aide fastened the stock around his neck, then straightened and nodded to me.
"I thank you, ma'am. 'Twas most gracious of you."
"Think nothing of it," I said, dry-mouthed. "My pleasure." It had come on to rain again. The cold drops struck my hands and face, and moisture glimmered on the strong bones of Jamie's face, caught trembling in his hair and thick lashes. Hayes shrugged himself into his coat and fastened the loop of his plaid with a small gilt brooch, the brooch his father had given him before Culloden.
"So Murchison is dead," he said, as though to himself. "I did hear..."
His fingers fumbled for a moment with the clasp of the brooch. "As how there were two brothers of that name,
alike as peas in a pod."
"There were," Jamie said. He looked up then and met Hayes's eyes. The lieutenant's face showed no more than mild interest.
"Ah, would you know then which it was?"
"No. But it is no matter. Both are dead."
"Ah," Hayes said again.
He stood a moment as though thinking, then bowed to Jamie, formally, bonnet held against his chest.
"Seamus MacBrien, may blessed Michael defend you."
He lifted the bonnet briefly to me, clapped it on his head, and turned to go, his aide following in silence. A gust of wind blew through the clearing with a chilly burst of rain upon it, so like the freezing April rain of Culloden. Jamie shivered suddenly beside me, with a deep convulsive shudder that crumpled the letter he still held in his hand. "How much do you remember?" I asked, looking after Hayes as he picked his way across the blood-soaked ground.
"Almost nothing," he replied.
He stood up and turned to look down at me, his eyes as dark as the clouded skies above.
"And that is still too much."
He handed me the crumpled letter. The rain had blotted and smeared the ink here and there, but it was still quite readable. By contrast to the proclamation, it contained two sentences. But the additional period didn't dilute its impact. "New Bern, 20th of October.
Colonel James Fraser. Whereas the peace and good order of this government has been lately violated, and much injury done to the persons and properties of many inhabitants of this province by a body of people who style themselves regulators, I do, by the advice of His Majesty's Council, order and direct you forthwith to call a general muster of so many men as you judge suitable to serve in a regiment of militia, and make report to me as soon as possible of the number of volunteers that are willing to turn out in the service of their king and country when called upon, and also what number of effective men belong to your regiment who can be ordered out in case of an emergency, and in case any further violence should be attempted to be committed by the insurgents.
Your diligent and punctual obedience to these orders will be well received by your obedient servant, William Tryon.
I folded the rain-spotted letter neatly up, noticing remotely that my hands were shaking. Jamie took it from me and held it between thumb and forefinger, as though it were some disagreeable object, as indeed it was. His mouth quirked wryly as he met my eyes.
"I'd hope for a little more time," he said.
Chapter 8. The Factor. After Brianna left to retrieve Jemmy from Jocasta's tent, Roger made his way slowly up the hill toward their own campsite. He exchanged greetings and accepted congratulations from people he passed, but scarcely heard what was said to him. "There'll be a next time," she'd said. He held the words close, turning them over in his mind like a handful of coins in his pocket. She hadn't been just saying it. She meant it. And it was a promise that at the moment meant even more to him than the one she'd made on their first wedding night. The thought of weddings reminded him finally that there was, in fact, another coming. He glanced down at himself and saw that Bree hadn't been exaggerating about his appearance. Damn, and it was Jamie's coat, too. He began to brush off the pine needles and streaks of mud, but was interrupted by a halloo from the path above. He looked up to see Duncan Innes making his way carefully down the steep slope, body canted to compensate for his missing arm. Duncan had put on his splendid coat, scarlet with blue facings and gold buttons, and his hair was plaited tight under a stylish new black hat. The transformation from Highland fisherman to prosperous landowner was startling. Even Duncan's attitude seemed changed, more confident by half. Duncan was accompanied by a tall, thin, elderly gentleman, very neat, but threadbare in appearance, his scanty white locks tied back from a high and balding brow. His mouth had collapsed from lack of teeth, but retained its humorous curve, and his eyes were blue and bright, set in a long face whose skin was stretched so tight across the bone as scarce to leave enough to wrinkle round the eyes, though deep lines carved the mouth and brow. With a long-beaked nose, and clad in rusty, tattered black, he looked like a genial vulture. "Smorach," Duncan hailed Roger, looking pleased. "The very man I hope to find. And I trust you're weel fettled against your marriage," he added, his eyes falling quizzically on Roger's stained coat and leaf-strewn hair. "Oh, aye," Roger cleared his throat, converting his coat brushing to a brief thump of his chest as though to loosen phlegm. "Damp weather for a wedding, though, eh?" "Happy the corpse the rain falls on," Duncan agreed, and laughed a little nervously. "Still, we'll hope not to die of the pleurisy before we're wed, eh, lad?" He settled the fine crimson coat more snugly on his shoulders, flicking an imaginary speck of dust from the cuff. "You're very fine, Duncan," Roger said, hoping to distract attention from his own disreputable state with a bit of raillery. "Quite like a bridegroom." Duncan flushed a little behind his drooping moustache, and his one hand twiddled with the crested buttons on his coat. "Oh, well," he said, seeming mildly embarrassed. "Miss Jo did say as she didn't wish to stand up with a scarecrow." He coughed and turned abruptly to his companion, as though the word had suddenly reminded him of the man's presence. "Mr. Bug, here's himself's good son, Roger Mack, him I tell you of." He turned back toward Roger, waving vaguely at his companion, who stepped forward, extending his hand with a stiff but cordial bow. "This will be Arch Bug, Asmarach." "Your servant, Mr. Bug," Roger said politely, slightly startled to observe that the large bony hand gripping his was missing its first two fingers. "Mm-hmm," Mr. Bug replied, his manner indicating that he reciprocated the sentiment sincerely. He might have intended to expand on the subject, but when he opened his mouth, a high-pitched feminine voice, a little cracked with age, seemed to emerge from it. "It's that kind, sir, of Mr. Freezer, and I'm sure as he'll have nae reason to regret it. Indeed he'll not, as I said to him myself. I
canna tell you what a blessing it is, and us not sure where our next bite was coming from, or how to keep a roof above our heads. I said to Arch, I said, now we must just trust in Christ and Our Lady, and if we mun starve, we shall do it in a state of grace. And Arch, he says to me...
A small round woman, threadbare and elderly as her husband, but likewise neatly mended, emerged into view, still talking. Short as she was, Roger hadn't seen her, hidden behind the voluminous skirts of her husband's ancient coat.
"Mistress Bug," Duncan whispered to him, unnecessarily, "I know but a silver heapney to bless ourselves with, and me a-wondering what was to become of us. And then that Sally McBride was saying as how she'd heard that Jamie Fraser had need of a good..."
Mr. Bug smiled above his wife's head. She halted in mid-sentence, eyes widening in shock at the state of Roger's coat.
"Why, look at that! Whatever have you been up to, lad? Have you had an accident? It looks as though someone's knocked you down and dragged you by your heels through the dung heap."
Not waiting for answers, she whipped a clean kerchief from the bulging pocket tied at her waist, spat liberally on it, and began industriously cleaning the muddy smears from the breast of his coat.
"Oh, you needn't, I mean, thanks."
Roger felt as though he'd been caught in some kind of machinery. He glanced at Duncan, hoping for rescue.
"Jimmy Roy's asked Mr. Bug to come and be a factor at the Ridge."
Duncan seized the momentary lull afforded by Mrs. Bug's preoccupation to give a word of explanation.
"Factor?"
Roger felt a small jolt at the word, as though someone had punched him just beneath the breastbone.
"Aye, for times when himself must be abroad or occupied with other business. For it's true enough, fields and tenants dinna tend themselves."
Duncan spoke with a certain note of ruefulness. Once a simple fisherman, he frequently found the responsibilities of running a large plantation onerous, and he glanced now at Mr. Bug with a small gleam of covetousness, as though he thought momentarily of tucking this useful person into his pocket and taking him home to River Run. Of course, Roger reflected, that would have meant taking Mrs. Bug too.
"And just the thing it is, too. Such good fortune. And me telling Arch just yesterday that the best we might hope for was to find work in Edentown or Cross Creek, with Arch maybe taking to the boats. But that's such a perilous living, is it not? Wet to the skin half the time, and deadly agues rising up from the swamps like ghoulies, and the air so thick with the miasma as it's not fit to breathe. And me perhaps to be taking in laundry in the dune while he was gone abroad on the water, though I'm sure I would hate that, for we haven't been apart one night since we were married, have we, my dearie?"
She cast a glance of devotion upward at her tall husband, who smiled gently down at her.
Perhaps Mr. Bug was deaf, Roger thought, or perhaps they'd only been married a week.
Without his needing to inquire, though, he was informed that the Bugs had been husband and wife for more than 40 years. Arch Bug had been a minor taxman to Malcolm Grant of Glenmoriston, but the years after the Rising had been hard. The estate he had held for Grant having been confiscated by the English Crown, Bug had made do for some years as a crofter, but then had been obliged by hardship and starvation to take his wife and their little remaining money and seek a new life in America.
"We had thought to try in Edinburgh," the old gentleman said, his speech slow and courtly with a soft Highland lilt. So he wasn't deaf, Roger thought, yet.
"For I had a cousin there as was to do with one of the banking houses, and we thought that perhaps it would be that he could speak a word in someone's ear.
But I was too ancient and lacked sufficient skill,
and lucky they would have been to have him too. But nay, such fools as they were, they wouldna think of it. And so we had to come awa' and try if we might."
Duncan met Roger's eyes and hid a smile beneath his drooping moustache as the tale of the Bug's adventures poured out in this syncopated fashion. Roger returned the smile, trying privately to dismiss a niggling sense of discomfort.
Factor?
Someone to oversee matters on the Ridge, to mind the planting, tend the harvest, deal with the concerns of tenants when Jamie Fraser was away or busy. An obvious necessity with a recent influx of new tenants, and the knowledge of what the next few years would bring. It wasn't until this moment, though, that Roger realised that he had subconsciously assumed that he would be Jamie's right hand in such affairs. Or the left, at least.
This ends Disc 4. The Fiery Cross, Disc 5.
Fergus assisted Jamie to some extent, riding on errands and fetching back information. Fergus's lack of a hand limited what he could do physically, though, and he couldn't be dealing with the paperwork or accounts. Jenny Murray had taught the French orphan her brother had adopted to read, after a fashion, but had failed utterly to give him a grasp of numbers. Roger stole a glance at Mr. Bug's hand, resting now in affection on his wife's plump shoulder. It was broad, work-worn, and strong-looking, despite the mutilation, but the remaining fingers were badly twisted with arthritis, the joints knobby and painful in appearance. So Jamie thought that even an elderly, half-crippled man would be better equipped than Roger to handle the affairs of Fraser's Ridge. That was an unexpectedly bitter thought. He knew his father-in-law had doubts of his ability, beyond any father's natural mistrust of the man bedding his daughter. Totally tone-deaf himself, Jamie would naturally not value Roger's musical gift. And while Roger was decently sized and hard-working, it was unfortunately true that he had little practical knowledge of animal husbandry, hunting, or the use of deadly weapons. And, granted, he had no great experience in farming or in running a large estate, which Mr. Bug plainly did. Roger would be the first to admit these things. But he was Jamie's son-in-law, or about to be. Damn it, Duncan had just introduced him that way. He might have been raised in another time, but he was a Highland Scot for all that, and he was well aware that blood and kinship counted for more than anything. The husband of an only daughter would normally be considered as the son of the house, coming only second to the head of the household in authority and respect. Unless there was something drastically wrong with him. If he were commonly known to be a drunkard, for instance, or criminally dissolute, or feeble-minded. Christ! Was that what Jamie thought of him? A hopeless numpty? Sit ye doon, young man, and I'll attend to this fine burachie. Mrs. Bug interrupted these dark musings. She pulled on his sleeve, making clicking noises of disapproval as she viewed the leaves and twigs in his hair. Look at ye, all gluthered and bashed about. Fighting, was it? Oh, weel, I hope the other fellow looks worse. That's all I can see. Before he could protest, she had him seated on a rock, had whipped a wooden comb from her pocket and the thong from his hair, and was dealing with his disordered locks in a brisk manner that felt calculated to rip several strands from his scalp. Thrush, is it, they call you? Mrs. Bug paused in her tonsorial activity, holding up a strand of glossy black and squinting suspiciously at it as though in search of vermin. "Why, but it's new for the colour of his bonny black locks," Duncan put in, grinning at Roger's obvious discomfiture. "It is for the singing. Honey-throated as a wee nightingale is Roger Mac." "Singing!" cried Mrs. Bug. She dropped the lock of hair, enchanted. "Was it you we heard last night, then? Singing and playing on the bodhran with it?" "Well, it might have been," Roger murmured modestly. The lady's unbounded admiration, expressed at length, flattered him and made him ashamed of his momentary resentment of her husband. After all, he thought, seeing the shabbiness of her much-mended apron and the lines in her face, the old people had clearly had a hard time of it. Perhaps Jamie had hired them as much from charity as from his own need of help. That made him feel somewhat better, and he thanked Mrs. Bug very graciously for her assistance. "Will you come along to our fire now?" he asked, with an inquiring glance at Mr. Bug. "You'll not have met Mrs. Fraser yet, I suppose, or—" He was interrupted by a noise like a fire-engine siren, distant but obviously coming closer. Quite familiar with this particular racket, he was not surprised to see his father-in-law emerge from one of the trails that criss-crossed the mountain, Jem squirming and squalling like a scalded cat in his arms. "Jamie, looking mildly harried, handed the child across to Roger. Roger took him and, for lack of any other inspiration, stuck his thumb in the wide-open mouth. The noise ceased abruptly and everyone relaxed. "What a sweet laddie!" Mrs. Bug stood a tiptoe to coo over Jem while Jamie, looking highly relieved, turned to greet Mr. Bug and Duncan. Sweet was not the adjective Roger himself would have chosen. Berserk seemed more like it. The baby was bright red in the face, the tracks of tears staining his cheeks, and he sucked furiously on the sustaining thumb, eyes squashed shut in an effort to escape a patently unsatisfactory world. What hair he had was sticking up in sweaty spikes and whorls, and he had come out of his wrappings, which hung in disreputable folds and draggles. He also smelled like a neglected privy, for reasons which were all too obvious. An experienced father, Roger at once instituted emergency measures.
"Where's Bree?" "God knows, and he's no telling," Jamie said briefly. "I've been searching the mountainside for her since the wain woke in my arms and decided he wasn't satisfied with my company."
He sniffed suspiciously at the hand which had been holding his grandson, then wiped it on the skirts of his coat.
"He's no so very pleased with mine either, seems like."
Jem was champing on the thumb, drool running down his chin and over Roger's wrist, uttering squeals of frustration. "Have you seen Marsali, then?" He knew Brianna didn't like anyone to feed Jemmy but herself, but this was plainly an emergency. He cast an eye about, hoping to spot a nursing mother somewhere nearby who might take pity on the child, if not on him.
"Let me have the poor wee bairnie," said Mrs. Bug, reaching for the baby, and immediately altering her status from chattering busybody to angel of light, so far as Roger was concerned.
"There now, Alannon, there, there."
Recognising a higher authority when he saw it, Jemmy promptly shut up, his eyes rounded with awe as he regarded Mrs. Bug. She sat down with the little boy on her lap and began to deal with him in the same firm and efficient manner with which she had just dealt with his father. Roger thought that perhaps Jamie had hired the wrong bug to be factor. Arch, though, was exhibiting both intelligence and competence, asking sensible questions of Jamie regarding stock, crops, tenants, and so forth.
"But I could do that," Roger thought, following the conversation closely.
"Some of it," he amended honestly, as the talk suddenly veered into a discussion of bag rot. Perhaps Jamie was right to seek someone more knowledgeable. But Roger could learn, after all.
"And who's the bonny laddie noo?"
Mrs. Bug had risen to her feet, cooing over Jemmy, now respectably transformed into a tightly swaddled cocoon. She traced the line of a round cheek with one stubby finger, then glanced at Roger.
"Aye, aye. His eye's just like his father, then, hasn't he?"
Roger flushed, forgetting about Bagrod.
"Oh, I should say he favours his mother, mostly."
Mrs. Bug pursed her lips, narrowing her eyes at Roger, then shook her head decidedly and patted Jem on the top of his head.
"Not the hair, maybe, but the shape of him. Aye, that's yours, lad. Those fine, broad shoulders."
She gave Roger a brief nod of approval and kissed Jem on the brow.
"Why, you shouldn't be surprised but what his een will turn green as he ages, either. Mark me, lad, he'll be the spit of you by the time he's grown. Won't you, wee manny?"
She nuzzled Jemmy.
"You'll be a big, braw lad like your da, won't you, then?"
"That's the usual thing folks say," he reminded himself,
trying to quell the absurd rush of pleasure he felt at her words.
"The old wifies, they always say as how a bairn resembles this one or that one."
He discovered suddenly that he was afraid even to admit the possibility that Jemmy could really be his. He wanted it so badly.
He told himself firmly that it didn't matter whether the boy was his by blood or not. He would love and care for him as his son. He would, of course. But it did matter, he found. Oh, it did.
Before he could say anything further to Mrs. Bug, though, Mr. Bug turned toward him to include him courteously in the men's conversation.
"Mackenzie, is it?" he asked. "And will you be one of the Mackenzies of Torridon, then? Or maybe from Kilmarnock?"
Roger had been fielding similar questions all through the gathering. Exploring a person's antecedents was the normal beginning of any Scottish conversation, something that wouldn't change a bit in the next 200 years, he thought. wariness tempered by the comfortable familiarity of the process. Before he could answer, though, Jamie's hand squeezed his shoulder.
"Roger Mack's kin to me on my mother's side," he said casually.